down the drum.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 145.PS11983, certificate number 16793. The Bottle Conjurer.
Row on my fake and off on Nagel, they'll never know you're just a bagel.
Razzle, dazzle them,
and they'll beg you for more.
Are you much of a prankster? I don't think of you as pranking people because it's kind of a little bit, it's a little bit naughty or nasty even.
I disliked pranking before it was cool to dislike pranking. I came of age in the early 80s.
Yes.
Where the media, you know, kind of the post-Animal House media told us that pranking was the highest form of art and culture and humor.
Yeah, right. It was the Porky's era.
Porky's Revenge of the Nerds era. Anything mean to do to anyone else is okay,
but it also,
especially if it victimizes women.
Yeah, it was very sexist.
It was
right?
Creepy. Yeah.
You're always trying to steal somebody's underwear or embarrass them or take their bra off in public.
And I always found pranks. I had a book of pranks which I thought were fun because they're clever. You know, stick a little suction cup faucet on the wall of the plane next to you and ask the stewardess what this is for. You know, or replace somebody's goldfish with progressively bigger fish every day. I like the ones that were like big ideas, long cons.
Yeah, the psychological ones where you replace someone's slippers with a pair that are a half size too small.
Right.
Increasingly small until the person goes insane.
But the thing about it, you know, the ethics of it are indefensible. You're doing some unannounced mean thing to someone. It's not even a joke. Who's the audience for this joke? If you and all your friends are observing and laughing, it's cruel.
Right.
If it's just you doing it for fun and then revealing it to the person, they didn't get to see the buildup, so they're not going to like it.
Sure, you're the sadist here.
On what level does it work? I find it very cringy, and often it just requires lying.
Oh,
Like a good prank will be like, you know, will have some element of, hey, you gotta, you know, your mom called, you gotta run over to her place.
Right.
The better to get the person off the premises.
You never did prank phone calls. You never said, is your refrigerator running or find that appealing at all?
Oh, I find it appealing because I thought the Jerky Boys were funny.
Yeah. Right.
But you know, exactly. It's the kind of thing that I would never do, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I like these things in the abstract as a skit.
Yeah. But you're a good boy.
I like to follow the rules. Yeah. I like to figure out what all the rules are in turn. So I can then follow all of them simultaneously.
Even when they're contradictory, you follow them both in different directions.
That's what the Bible's for. You got to do the things and then the things that contradict the things.
I had a long-standing, well, still do, long con on Dick Cheney.
Wow, does he know?
He doesn't know because I've never been able to actually get him alone. But the project was to... This began back during the Bush administration. I was going to find a way.
One would assume.
Yeah. I was going to find a way to get some of the worst culprits of that era of politics, including Lawrence Eagleburger, who I had a special fondness for. And I was going to capture them, you know, like with chloroform, using a team of very leftist former Navy SEALs. So that was the first completely implausible premise.
Where are you going to find those guys?
And we were going to bury some shipping containers in the desert, far up a dirt road, create an underground sort of cavern.
And this is more than you've ever prepared for an omnibus entry.
Yeah. And then I was going to build little apartments in these shipping containers under the ground. And these culprits were going to wake up in these shipping containers that were going to be, you know, basically a one bedroom or a studio apartment. But over the course of time, I was going to increase the dosage of LSD in their drinking water whilst also just very subtly while they slept, changing the dimensions of the room so that the walls no longer were exactly parallel. But I would also change the fixtures to match the walls. So the bed would also become a sort of trapezoid. Yeah.
Man, IKEA would have done such great business off of this plan. If you and Mossad were gonna.
Yeah, the plan, of course, would be to watch these people go nuts. Because I would be controlling every element of their environment.
The only thing keeping Dick Cheney sane right now is the fact that his bedboards meet at right angles.
That's exactly it.
And if that were to change to any degree, he would immediately come unglued.
This is the small slipper
and realize thing. His sins.
But if your slippers got smaller every day and your drinking water went from micro doses of LSD to slightly perceptible doses of LSD.
Have you considered that the LSD element of your plan maybe makes it so you don't have to change the decor?
No. It's the LSD would be, you know, they'd just be sitting there like, whoa, all of a sudden the wallpaper is moving. But if the wallpaper also was like changing from day to day and you kind of lost whatever your anchor reality was, I really feel like
that. I don't think you should be talking about this on the show because now you've ruined the joke for when you actually do this.
Dick Cheney will not listen to Omnibus. When it happens to Dick Cheney, it will be in an underground bunker so no one else will know.
What podcasts do you think Dick Cheney enjoys? Like, you think he's a Radiolab guy?
No, I mean like Shotgun Fans and...
What if he's really into? What if he and his wife are really into true crime?
I feel like he and his wife have a BDSM relationship, so there might be that.
Suggest some podcasts. I gotta say, I don't know the space that well.
I'm not sure I do either. I've never listened to a BDSM podcast.
I don't think you even know what. Where do those letters go in?
BSDM.
BMDDS. I had a friend named Cameron, who was a prank guy and uh-huh. and took a lot of relish in it. He was actually, I think he might have been the one that showed me Jerky Boys, but he was a benevolent example of the species.
Oh, isn't that sweet?
And his pranks, he would have me join in on them. They were calibrated to be essentially, not victimless in the sense that they would bring a sense of blessing and wonder to the audience.
So when he was like reading scripture out loud, he would change certain words that would make everyone in the church laugh.
What a good one. No, that kind of guy gets evicted from the community very quickly.
Of course.
No, this was more along the lines of, I always enjoyed the pranks of, you know, where a Jeep is built part by part in somebody's dorm room, or a donkey appears on the college dorm, or, you know, just the nerdy Caltech hacks where everybody lifts up the sign at the football game and it says Stanford, but it's backwards. It's in mirror writing.
We did that the last week of my senior year in high school. We went and actually stole a piece of playground equipment from the local evangelical church parking lot and reassembled it in the middle of our high school, like, multi-purpose room. So on the, you know, last day of school, everyone came in and there was this giant piece of playground equipment.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, it was good.
I mean, it was not for the evangelicals. They're kind of hating it.
That's not a thing that we worried about.
Did you put it back?
No. I mean, we didn't actually get in trouble because we were actually pretty good at this prank.
Yeah, and that's the thing about this kind of prank is it actually is a moment of performance for an audience that doesn't actually victimize anyone, because it's a little more like a magic trick than an act of cruelty. You know, here's the prestige. There's a donkey on the roof. And my friend's pranks were often very much like that. He showed me one where you cover somebody's dorm room door with paper, and then you fill the space in between the paper and the door with balloons. And then you seal it up like the cask of Amontillado. So there's a foot deep layer of balloons in between. And as long as you've ensured that their door opens inward, which
right.
not all doors do, but if it's a door that opens inward, they will open their door only to have a wall of balloons fall on them.
Oh, that's wonderful. Unless they have a heart attack.
Which is beautiful and harmless. Yeah. And that happens about half the time. You do like
you kill the person.
Yeah. Over about half the time this prank has been attempted, the people have died of joy, though, for seeing a wall of balloons coming at them. They would have no regrets in a hypothetical afterlife.
Yeah, I mean, it's like at its most benign, it's just a surprise party,
which I don't love either.
Yeah,
I mean that kind of goes against my sense of
not wanting to have a party or to have people in your house.
Both, yeah. But also just not as a guest, not wanting to jump out from behind somebody's couch,
right?
Because. You know, the main thing I expect of a couch is that nobody's going to jump out from, even ahead of comfort. Like when I buy a couch, the first thing I do is look behind it.
Right.
To see, is anybody going to jump out from behind this one?
I am also not a prankster very much. I just don't have that much planning ability.
I see.
You know, everything I do is a surprise to me in the minute.
You might be a prankster. You just don't know because you've never had enough coffee.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Like I don't even think an hour ahead. So how would I pull off a prank that required 3 days of preparation?
Please, if you're listening to this, suggest to John a prank that can work with perfect spontaneity and no preparation whatsoever.
I mean,
and mail it to Omnibus Project, PO Box 557-44, Shoreline.
Kind of the opposite of the Van Halen replace your Jack Daniels with iced tea so that you can go out on stage and chug a bottle of Jack Daniels and continue to play the show. You could put Jack Daniels in someone's pitcher of iced tea, but again, that would be a terrible prank.
It is. You know, you're a recovering alcoholic. You shouldn't be putting Jack Daniels in other people's iced tea.
Back in the old days, this was a prank that was done to me. I was at a fraternity party in Ithaca, New York, on the campus of Cornell University. And they were doing beer bongs, which is a thing that...
I don't know what that is.
You've never done. But a beer bong is where you put a bunch of beer... Not just your usual one can of beer,
but a bunch,
multiple beers in a giant, you know, you get an apparatus. And this is another thing that someone else has to plan, right? I never did this myself, but you go to a party and there's a giant funnel and then a long piece of tubing. And you put as many beers as you can fit into a giant funnel and a long piece of tubing. And sometimes quite a few beers. And then you put the length of, it's like siphoning gas from a car. You put the tube in your mouth and then your friends lift the funnel and the tube up as high as they can. And the beer goes into you as fast as
like, and it's the best day of Brett Kavanaugh's life.
You're just, yeah, that's exactly what it is. You're just basically choking down this beer. Cause it's, you know, there's a lot of force behind it at its highest point.
And what sense does a bong?
A bong, you know, you often like...
I guess it's carbonated.
Well, like a hookah, you would put a tube in your mouth and you would, you know, with a hookah, you end up, the more suction there is on the bowl, the denser the smoke once it...
I'm just saying this is a smoke-free...
Yeah.
I mean, is it a bong in any meaningful sense if it's just a carbonated drink? Can I have like a Dr. Pepper bong?
You could. But it would be, I think you would have
shotgunning Dr. Peppers.
You would have a hard time consuming like 6 Dr. Peppers. I don't know what's so special about beer that you can drink a lot of it where you could never drink that many Cokes. You couldn't sit and drink 12 Cokes.
Does that have to be light beer? I feel like this is a very heavy evening if you're...
It's a gnarly experience, but you know, when you're in a fraternity and you're 19 years old, you know, consuming 12 beers...
You can do anything.
That's small beer.
19-year-olds are just... superheroes.
And I was a major beer consumer at the time. And anyway, we were, because this was Cornell and it was full of, you know, MIT almosts. MIT also ran.
The MITAs.
At this fraternity, they had built a beer bong that was so large that the...
Not even light could escape.
No, you could hold the funnel from the second floor of the fraternity. And it was, you know, it's like eating a eating a 50-ounce steak or whatever. It was if you could eat it, your beer was free. There weren't very many people that were going to attempt this beer bong, but of course I was somebody that was always going to do a stunt. I was always going to try and eat the steak.
And you're a big boy.
I was a big boy. I can drink a lot of beer. So I was like, sure, you can, you know, I'm going to do the second story beer bong. And because it's already up high, the pressure on your mouth of the beer when it was up that high, you know, it was pretty substantial. You had to really hold it in. And so, you know, I open up the bong, I'm drinking the beer, you know, chug, 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 chug. And someone up on the second floor had upturned a bottle of booze in the top of the...
And knowing what they were doing. This was
intentional.
A prank, right? On you.
You're going to drink as many beers as this is. And then mid-chug, as you're nearing the end of your, you know, your capacity for beer, you're going to get an undergraduate killing amount of booze.
It's a Boilermaker bong.
And, you know, of course, you only have to take a few chugs to realize that you're drinking jet fuel now, and you're, you know, and I stopped, and everybody laughed, ha, 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 ha. And then I was just wasted. It was a terrible, terrible prank. And barfed, you know. Of course, you're going to have to barf after that.
Yeah, putting balloons in somebody's front door, they rarely vomit from surprise or delight.
Yeah, I mean, I played rugby. I deserved everything I got.
Is it even possible to be so delighted that you would throw up?
To be so delighted? Well, it depends. Like, how do you feel about teacup rides at Disneyland?
Well, that's not delight.
No.
Is there? But I'm seriously, is there a stuffed animal or some kind of Easter tableau that would just be so adorable that you would just have no choice but to...
It feels like something that would happen to a Japanese girl.
it's a medical condition we do not have in the West.
Yeah, that you see a stuffed panda and you're so excited that you barf. Like tiny barf, like cute barf.
There's a fun emoji for fun barfing. I could believe that there's a manga signifier for
barfing out of cuteness.
Delighted barfing.
I just made a barf sound, and I'm sorry, but I don't think it was very cute. I think the barf would be tee bleep, bleep. Even that isn't very cute.
Yeah, it wouldn't be real. There's no cute barf. Sound.
It would depend. Would you? You'd have to be eating gummy bears all morning for the barf to be cute.
It's the worst. There's no food makes
cute barf.
Cute barf. It's just the worst experience.
Yeah, there's enough. There's enough bile in your stomach.
I'll do anything to avoid barfing. Really?
Oh, really? You're not a barfer?
No. You enjoy it?
No. I'm not a barfer either. I even when I'm really sick, even when I have food poisoning, I hardly ever barf.
I mean, it feels, you know, it's a great relief.
But. Yeah, but I also enjoy the feeling of having food poisoning and not barfing. I really ride it, you know?
You're like, I deserve this.
This is a hair shirt, you know? I had some bad tacos and I'm going to suffer this punishment.
I had this coming.
Well, one of the sort of great pranks of its era involved kind of exactly what you described as like the kind of a bad prank where you give a whole crowd of people not what they're expecting. And you said at some point that it was unlikely that a prank, no matter how bad, would be unlikely to cause a riot. You might not have said it on the show. That might have just been something you say as one of your normal adages.
It's kind of one of my catchphrases. Yeah. Like people be like, hey, Ken, how's it hanging? And I'll say, not bad enough a prank to cause a riot. People love that.
But this is a prank that caused a riot. And you don't usually think of, I mean, when we think of the 18th century, before the American Revolution, I mean, we think of the people of the 18th century as being pretty sporting. Pretty fun. It was a fun era.
They pulled their stockings up to their knees where their pants start.
That's right. So they're wearing powdered wigs.
Which is fun.
That is fun.
They might have little, do they have little beauty spots? Are we in France?
Yeah. No, we're not. We're in England where that would have been considered French decadence.
But they have coffee now. So they're really wired during the day.
Coffee and pipes.
They're ready to write some satirical pamphlets.
There's a lot of satirical pamphleting during this time. And we'll see that also plays a role later in our show. But yeah, this is post-Enlightenment or, you know, like this is a time when you could be a deist. And that was like...
And you still get invited places.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You could start a new government.
You wouldn't get, you know, previously you'd be burned at the stake.
Right.
But now you get invited over to Madame Whatever's and she's like, do tell us about your clockwork god, Sir Arnold.
And there was an awful, particularly in the upper classes, but I think this was true of everyone. There was a lot of pride and prominence given to wit, which I think also was true in Shakespeare's time, right? The Samuel Pepys diaries.
Samuel Johnson. He's the funny one.
He was funny.
Pepys is funny too, but, I think.
Yeah, Pepys.
People named Samuel, man. Just hilarious. Samuel Clemens, last funny Samuel.
Is that true? Yeah, I guess. Well,
maybe the last Samuel of any kind.
I mean, Sam Gamgee was a little bit of a wag, but he predates Samuel Clemens, doesn't he, by several millennia?
No, actually, the Hobbit books take place in a post-apocalyptic future. Did you not know this?
Oh, it's not a galaxy far, far away, long time ago?
No, that's the crazy thing. Star Wars is in the past, Tolkien's in the future.
Oh, sure, because all of those creatures are mutations.
That's right.
Resulted from chemical waste.
Yeah, there's a big volcano spewing stuff. It's because of the meteor that landed. Oh,
thank you for explaining that entire universe. It makes a lot more sense to me now.
You're very welcome.
But during this period, there was, I think, a lot of within the social strata of the British Empire, there was a lot of contempt. This may be hard for you to believe, but there was a lot of contempt for the lower classes.
What? Unlike today. Where people love the poor and marginalized.
You're not allowed to.
Especially in Britain.
You're not allowed to mock the poor and marginalized now. You were then. It's not to say that there's not still tremendous contempt for them in the culture, but you're not allowed to show it.
I've said this because they have it hard enough. It's this common sense rule. Look, here's the thing about poor people. They're really poor. The last thing they need at the end of a hard day of being poor is to hear your bummer jokes about them.
Sure.
And in fact, in the past, having written a book about the history of comedy, the only acceptable targets for humor were people beneath you. Like punching down was not only allowed, it was compulsory. Right. You could never make fun of a priest or a king. You know, these were people that had divine sanction.
Right.
So the only,
you'd get beheaded.
The safe targets were the ones who could not behead you, which is anybody below you.
Well, and that was, and actually the theater was one of the places that you could satirize the upper classes, right? I mean, Shakespeare is full of allusions, and that was even more so true in the 18th century. Theater was kind of the bastion of the ribald.
You'd go see Absalom and Achitophel, and you'd be like, wait a second. I think Absalom might be one of the Stuart kings.
Yeah, exactly.
Or something. I don't know if that's true.
You know, nursery rhymes, I guess, we now understand were all jabs at various kings.
I don't believe that. That seems like revisionist bull.
It does a little
Old King Cole was clearly Henry II Plantagenet. Was he, though?
I do feel like that's somebody trying to write a novel thesis paper to get their PhD. And
without having to do much work, because the source text is literally four lines
of
8 syllables each.
Nobody really reads literature theses anyway. It's just you have to stand up there and dance around, rattle your tambourine, and you're going to get that doctorate.
That's right.
But in the mid-18th century, during this period that I'm sort of trying to flesh out for you,
you're really painting a vivid picture too.
Yeah, thank you. All the dukes and duchesses and earls and
countesses
and viscounts and viscountesses used to stand around in drawing rooms and make one another laugh, presumably not yet drinking absinthe, but whatever Bombay gin. Whatever the drink of choice would have been for those people to get messed up.
Gin's for the poor. I don't know what those people were drinking.
What were they drinking? It's never occurred to me to... This is something that...
Is it some flavored liqueur? Is it like some weird orange liqueur or...
Some probably large group of craft cocktail futurelings...
They're so angry right
now. ...are going to run in and tell us...
They're screaming which whiskey it actually... Single malt whiskey it would have been.
That's probably what it was, right? Scottish whiskey.
I don't know.
Irish whiskey. No. They wouldn't have consumed some beverage from the peat bogs of Ireland. Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, alcohol futurelings, don't write us because Ken and I are both... teetotalers and we don't really care.
Not only are we not in the appropriate time period to drink with these people, we also, we would just be asking if they had a Diet Coke.
Were they drinking wine or was that also déclassé?
I bet they were drinking wine.
Well, anyway, standing around drinking around a giant fireplace one day in the mid-18th century, some nobles, among whom was the Duke of Portland and the Earl of Chesterfield and various other dukes and earls.
What if the Duke of Portland is just some dude on a unicycle with like a ferret?
The Duke of Portland actually, his son, William, became the Prime Minister of England.
What?
And although the Duke himself was not really a, he wasn't busy like meddling in politics, his great, 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 great granddaughter is Queen Elizabeth.
Oh.
So he became, as is so often the case with those dukes, he became one of the great forefathers.
The Portland who became prime minister actually had a Cavendish as part of his hyphenated name. He might be related to the Cavendishes or Cavendi of previous Omnibi.
Right. Right. Well, you know,
it's all one big family.
It's all one big family, right? They're all cousins of cousins. But they're standing around together, laughing at the poor.
Doing incest.
Well, but also laughing at the middle class, even more than the poor, because the middle class, I mean, this is the thing about, as you were saying, you know, don't punch down upon the poor. But in fact, the true working poor aren't on Twitter to even recognize it.
And so, if you're the Duke of Portland, the poor have no faces even. Right. Like what's awful is these middle class people popping up, making themselves known,
the
thinking
they're
all that.
The bourgeoisie, people that are writing witty broadsides. And that's true in our own day. I mean, the people that are most offended are the ones exactly one rung laterally on whatever social ladder still exists.
I mean, they're a bigger threat. I don't know if these people can existentially sense that the middle class is coming for them, the mercantile class is coming for them.
Well, it's just that someone like you with 500,000 Twitter followers is feels threat from 10,000 people with 300 Twitter followers.
She added up. if they ever figure out they can gang up on me, good heavens.
But part of the part of this witty conversation, the topic turned to the gullibility of the middle class, and in particular, the gullibility of theater audiences, because this was a time...
Yeah, finally, we're going to stick it to them. These guys think there's a thunderstorm on the moor at the end of King Lear, idiots.
This was a time when it was actually, you know, in order to put on a play, you actually kind of had to have... There were what you would, I guess, describe as copyright laws. You couldn't just throw a play up. You had to have a royal endorsement for certain productions.
And yes. The crown could shut down the theaters at any time.
And the crown actually, you know, owned some portion of the theaters or some either portions of individual theaters or actually a portion of the theaters.
Just like how today the president owns the Kennedy Center.
Yeah.
He can be like, we're going to have ice capades, and they have to do it.
And the Ford Theater. I mean, famously, Trump would go over there every afternoon.
Lincoln was like, I got a request. I got a special request.
So a lot of the diversions were of a coarser nature, magic shows and incredible feats. Theater owners would, you know, try to fill up the theater with
Dog act?
Yeah,
is it like proto-vaudeville?
Yeah, pre-vaudeville. Things that, you know, that delighted the senses.
Oh, like is there some freak show element? Like, you know, Elephant Man is Victorian era, but...
There would have been, I think, maybe more of a... some of those technologies might not have yet been invented, but of course there's always been freak shows.
Little people having not yet been invented.
But I don't think, I think, you know, this was a class of people that went to the theater. And when we think of the Cirque Theater and the rabble and the ribald nature of those audiences, mm-hmm. which again is another kind of revisionism about Shakespeare, it wasn't high art. Then it was much more, those were rowdy crowds.
Tuppence would get you in.
But they're still theater goers. They're not, which I guess now we think of as real poshers. But even in Seattle 20 years ago, the people that went to the theater were the cool rock and roll people.
I would say that's not my experience. I'm usually the youngest person in any theater production.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to see Les Miserables instead of, you know, instead of like the heroin theater of 1995. But anyway, within this one particular cocktail party, there was an assertion made by the second Duke of Montague, or Montagu. I think.
Did you get in trouble for saying Montague?
No, because there's no E at the end. And I think the E turns the U into a U or a G.
In France it would.
But it's just M-O-N-T-A-G-U. Can that be Montague or would it be Montagu?
I don't know.
Well, the Duke of Montagu is one of those titles that no longer exists.
We can't ask anyone.
No, it came into existence as a kind of royal award. One son, John, became the second Duke of Montagu and then died childless. His daughter married an earl. The earl was elevated to dukedom and became the second iteration of the first Duke of Montagu.
Oh, it was a reboot.
It was a reboot. And then they had no male heir. I think the second Duke of Montagu maybe had something like 8 kids, but all the boys died. And so
it's not good for your dukedom.
That's right. Only daughters, but the daughter married an earl who then was elevated to the dukedom, but they didn't have a male heir. And so the Duke of Montagu has evaporated 2 separate times. And I think some subsequent earl, you know, all that stuff has to get inherited. So the daughter married someone else and eventually the dukedom of Montagu got subsumed beneath some other dukedom. And that duke is now called the Duke of something hyphenated Montagu.
Here's what I'm getting out of it. I'll never meet the Duke of Montagu.
Almost certainly no. You won't meet this one because he was born late 16th century.
Wow.
Or no, I'm sorry, late 17th century. But he was all of these characters that I've mentioned, the Duke of Portland, the Earl of Chesterfield, the Duke of Montagu, they were all wits and prominent wits of their day. And apparently, the second Duke of Montagu, suggested to the members of his cocktail party that the current theater-going audience was so gullible, so culpable, that he could mount almost any production, advertise almost any production, and it would sell out a theater. And the Duke of Montagu had a relationship with a theater in the West End. And the West End by this point was already kind of the theatrical district of...
That's nice when you go to a play there. It's like 300, 400 years of history, which, you know, Broadway was a peach orchard.
Yeah, right, exactly. There were theaters. I mean, the earliest theater there was built in, I think, the 1600s. It didn't become the West End of fame. Fame and fortune, you know, a theater district that now has dozens.
And of Cats theaters. wouldn't open for another 10 years.
That's right. The
Andrew Lloyd Webber was still a boy.
What was the big production about? Oh, it was Lady Saigon. What was that called?
Miss Saigon.
Miss Saigon. Right.
Helicopters.
No, that would have
helicopters been land on you.
Right. Or the Book of Mormon. Did you see the Book of Mormon?
I have. It doesn't have any helicopters.
Is it funny?
Was
it funny to you?
Yeah, it's not in very good taste.
I mean, the audience is laughing, but is there like always a section up in one of the boxes of super mad Mormons?
Angry Mormon elders?
We have to see this, but we don't want to. This is rude.
No, I mean, it's South Park. The jokes all land, but they're maybe kind of mean or a bad idea.
Yeah.
Like, 'cause a lot of them are about like African poverty, which, you know, good one.
But it's not at the expense of Canadians like their other work.
No, it's mostly Mormons and people with AIDS in Africa. So, you know, the Mormons can take it, but it's a little mean to the people with AIDS in Africa.
I never saw it. I couldn't afford it.
Hey, John.
Hi, Ken.
Have you been keeping up with the new t-shirt designs?
I think that that our current t-shirt designs are so awesome that I don't want them to expire at the end of the month. I want them to go another month.
They are continuing throughout the entire month in which you are listening to this.
Hooray!
That's for sure. If you haven't looked at the designs, you can go to omnibusproject.com/store, where our current t-shirt designs reside. This month, there is two Omnibus Classics. There's a Chick Tract inspired shirt with a fictional Omnibus theme. It looks really good. It's kind of drawn in the plausible style of a Chick Tract.
Yes.
And it looks great. And I like this one too. There's the Peachy Folder, which instead of the normal, what are the normal athletes on a Peachy Folder? Let me see.
There's the tennis. There's the basketball. There's the football.
There's the batter.
There's the skier.
But this one has
the cross-country
this one
runners.
Has you playing rugby.
Yep.
Right. This has me. What am I even doing? I'm interviewing. I'm metal detecting for. What do we call this? The floating feet, the Vancouver floating feet.
Oh, the classic 50s sport of metal detecting for feet.
Or maybe I'm interviewing them. I have like a mic. Like I look like I'm doing a 50s man on the street interview with the floating feet.
Okay. Well, it's cool looking in any case.
And then there's a bear holding a missile. I don't even know. How does that relate to the Omnibus? And the famous mascot of our show, Bear Holding Missile. Mm-hmm. You love him. You know you love him. These are very cool designs, thanks to our friends at Mediocrity.
They are super cool, and I think they are they really exemplify what Omnibus is all about. And if you're wearing one out in the world and you see someone else coming through the rye wearing an Omnibus t-shirt, you'll know fast friends, perhaps life partners.
And in fact, it's required to do one of those jumping chest butts.
Oh, yeah.
Even if the pandemic is still going on, I'm sorry.
Even if you can't jump.
Right. Even if you have a half-inch vertical, you still got to try.
Propel yourself at the other person by whatever means of locomotion you choose and collide with them.
If you enjoy Omnibus and you are not wearing Omnibus shirts, you can check that out at omnibusproject.com/store to see what cool things are available.
And going forward, there will be new t-shirt designs there all the time. We kept these over just because they're so great and demand has been so high. The Duke of Montagu had a relationship with a theater that was called the Theater in the Haymarket. And it was put up, and I think the first production was actually sponsored by the Duke. It was a group of French comedians known as Montagu's French Comedians in the kind of witty,
I love MFC
aside of the time. But the Duke says, okay, let's test this out. And the other aristocrats are like, are you sure about that? I doubt very much that you could.
This is the kind of thing that happens in novels where a wager over brandy turns into brandy. That's what they're drinking. Where a wager over brandy turns into a trip around the world or a crazy construction project. But in this case, it actually did happen. They remembered the next day what they're... Because normally these dissolute rich people, you'd think they'd forget the next day what they were yelling about the night before.
No, this was one of those bets, exactly, where they all were gathered around a urinal and made a one-pound bet about whether or not this could happen. And so there was an ad placed in one of the broadsides that read the following. At the new theater in the Haymarket on Monday next, the 16th instant, and they're talking about the month of January 1749.
That's what you would say, the 16th instant?
The 16th instant.
Does that mean January 16th?
Well, it means the next 16th, the oh, Monday next.
The, oh, I see. The 16th instant. I see, the upcoming 16th.
Upcoming 16th. To be seen, a person who performs the several most surprising things following.
Ooh.
Now, there's only a couple things that are surprising following.
You don't think it qualifies as several?
No, I mean, is a couple three?
You think a couple is three. You probably think a several is
several's 20. Be five at least, six. There's only a couple. First, he takes a common walking cane, which were common at the time, from any of the spectators, and thereon plays the music of every instrument now in use.
Pretty good.
And likewise, sings to surprising perfection.
Well, that's not so good. I mean, it's easy to find Susan Boyle sings to surprising perfection.
Yeah, but if you're playing the music of a clarinet on a walking cane.
At the same time.
Or a harpsichord, even more outrageous, and then sings to perfection. Interesting.
I'm just saying it's already good. You don't need the singing. It's gilding the lily.
But here is the second and final surprising thing. So
this is a couple.
Quite a few less than several. Secondly, he presents you with a common wine bottle, so that we're drinking wine, which any of the spectators may first examine. This bottle is placed on a table in the middle of the stage, and he, without any equivocation, so not even the slightest bit of hesitancy,
which would ruin the act,
goes into it in sight of all the spectators and sings in it. During his stay in the bottle, any person may handle it and see plainly that it does not exceed a common tavern bottle. So... This is the poster. This is the advertisement. Come to the new theater in the Haymarket and see a man climb into a wine bottle.
Would you go to such a show if you saw this on a pasted to a Capitol Hill telephone pole?
Well, it's curious. I mean, I'm not one to go to magic shows. I like, you know, close-up magic. I went to the Magic Castle and watched them find the Ace of Hearts in a potted fern. I'm not sure would I go to this kind of spectacle. I'm sorry. The bottle conjurer was going to do a couple or at least one additional trick.
He has an encore.
Those on the stage or in the boxes may come in masked habits, wow, if agreeable to them. And the performer, if desired, will inform them who they are. So he'll be able to know your identity even in a masked habit.
That is still a bit. Well, yeah. I mean, not with the masks, but, you know, there's still dopes on stage being like, yes, sir, your brother's name starts with an R, or maybe it has an A.
Yeah, right. Or it might be like, this is your life, Groucho Marx.
That's still a thing.
And then finally, to entice an audience, these performances have been seen by most of the crowned heads of Asia, Africa, and Europe. And never appeared public anywhere but one, but will wait on any at their houses and perform as above for £5 each time.
Wait, he'll come to your house and do the show for £5?
And do this for £5, which seems like not very much now.
Well, it's kind of a deal, isn't it?
Well, but then, I mean, £5 was, that was basically your inheritance.
Is that what he'll earn from doing the show and a hypothetical magician would earn for a full house?
Perhaps quite a bit more, but as you know, a house show is money in your pocket. You walk out at the end of the night, you don't have to sit in the back room and listen to somebody go down the list of expenses and say, well, you guys did drink an awful lot of beer.
So if you were to name a prize to do...
To get into a bottle? would be more than £5.
Let's say you have to get into a bottle and sing Cinnamon at somebody's house.
Hmm.
Is that more or less than...
Well, you know, a lot of my peers will do a show at your house for $750.
They'll just go to some Tajikistani dictator's birthday with Hillary Swank,
yeah,
and do the hits.
You know, Dave Bazan, I think, famously did multiple tours for $500 a night. Because with your own band, although you might make $2,500 a night, after you've paid for gas and hotels and paid everybody in the band, you probably make less than $500 or $750 for yourself.
You just need to have an act where it's just you and a bottle.
Exactly. And a different bottle every night, right? I mean, because... He doesn't say how he's going to get out of the bottle, but even that's not much overhead. I won't play your house for $750 because I make that price significant enough that it dissuades people from asking me to do it because I don't want to.
You can do a smaller number of them.
Yeah, I'll do a much smaller number.
Is that number zero?
At a much, much larger price. No, it is not zero. People have met my price, but it's rare. It's the rare.
Well, this is free advertising. The rare family. I've just given you.
That's right. If you want me to play at your house.
The bottle conjurer of the 21st century.
You have to submit an application.
Mr. John Roderick, you may wear masks if so desired.
Well, in the, to prove Montague's point, the show sold out. And
it's the dumbest point. If you promise people a really good show, they will attend. Wow. Good. What an amazing discovery about human nature.
But as you think about it, very hard to imagine a full-grown man climbing into a wine bottle.
But all magic tricks, when described, are supposed to sound implausible. That's otherwise they wouldn't be a magic trick.
Right, I suppose that's true. You make a horse disappear. But even so, putting a bottle on stage and inside of everyone who, you know, crowd has inspected the
bottle. This would be a good one.
It's a pretty good one.
This would be like a David Copperfield TV special.
Now, for me, I think
this is not just Penn and Teller dicking around on a morning show.
Yeah, exactly. If I'm going to pay an entry fee to see a show, I want it to be longer than yeah. 5 minutes.
Yeah, does he have an opening act who, right? Puts his toe in a bottle or something?
It seems like, you know, if this show started at 5, it would be over by 5:30, and that's, I mean, why even bother? Although I guess the middle classes were just milling about in the street smoking cigarettes and talking about...
They got plenty of time. Yeah,
deism. Anyway, the theater sells out, and on the night of the show... and Montague was all of these characters, if you read their bios, it says famous wit of the day. But Montague was a notorious prankster and not just a wit, but like his mother-in-law described him thus. He was a practical joker. She said, all his talents lie in things only natural in boys of 15 years old. And he is about 2 and 50. And I don't understand why they all talk like Yoda.
She's so proud of her daughter's jerk of a husband.
He likes to get people into his garden and wet them with squirts.
Well,
and to invite people to his country houses and put things in beds to make them itch. And 20 such pretty fancies as these.
This guy is totally doing fox hunts with the village peasants, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. He's the duke that. That you show up at his house because you're pleased to have been invited, and then he puts itching powder in your bed.
Boo.
I mean, how many times is he going to pull that off? I actually, now that I think about it, my dad used to take me to magic stores in the mid-70s, and I did get the dog poop and the cigarette loads and the itching powder.
Sure.
The whoopee cushions. I was actually reprimanded in elementary school.
For whoopee cushioning?
No, third grade, I brought itching powder on the school bus and then opened it. And itching powder, I don't know if you know, but flies everywhere. Like a gust of wind came in the window. The itching powder went everywhere. And the entire school bus was, they all had to go home. They had to go home and take baths because they were, and I was in big trouble.
Do you know what itching powder is often made from?
It's like asbestos, right? Or
yeah, I mean, it's any kind of fiber like that, but there are natural sources, like tarantula hair.
What?
Can be used as itching powder.
How do you farm tarantula hair?
You just get a little tiny Gillette five-blade razor, and you get the tarantula, the smoothest shave it's ever got. That's where Dungeness crabs come from.
Oh.
A lot of people don't know that.
We've got crab legs. See, golly. That's
are they a sponsor now?
Are there sea galleys down here? No, they're not. Anyway, so the night of the show, January 16th, the sold-out crowd arrives in the theater and sit waiting for the show to begin. And the Duke of Montague has not, I don't think, you know, speaking as a contemporary wag, has not thought this all the way through to present a dog and pony show or some,
He's got nobody to go up on stage.
Yeah, he doesn't come out with a banjo.
For him, the prank ended when the place filled up.
That's exactly right. The show was sold out, and he and his fellows laughed over their brandy.
It's the most whimsical jig of the season.
But from the audience's standpoint, they sit in the cheap seats, but also in their boxes, and await the show, and the hours tick by.
They want to see a dude go into a bottle.
One of the attendees is actually the Duke of Cumberland, the third son of King George the First. So, you know, there's royalty in the box.
Well, that proves not only that the middle classes are easy to fool with implausible placards.
It does.
But the aristocrats as well.
He's making a mockery even of his own, well, of his betters. So
I want the queen to walk in, like at the end of Pirates of Penzance.
I know, wouldn't that? I mean, the Prince of Wales is up there talking to his orchids. So the house lights come up. The crowd starts to hiss and boo. An employee of the theater comes out and says, "If he doesn't arrive, if the bottle conjurer doesn't arrive, In a half hour, we'll refund your ticket price, which suggests that the theater itself was duped. The manager of the theater, Samuel Foote, was like a prominent theatrical impresario. He was an actor of great renown who then sort of went into management, as one does. And it seems like they also were in the dark. The Duke of Montagu having, as you say, his joke concluded to his satisfaction.
I would have told the front of house people, I think. I'm a compassionate joker.
Well, that's not what happened here. And at one point, someone from the crowd shouts out, for double the price, he'll get into a pint bottle.
Oh.
And the room kind of cracks up, but then that begins real distemper. And, there starts to be like lots of hissing and rah, rah, rah. And then someone from one of the boxes up above throws a lighted candle on the stage.
Oh.
At which point, pandemonium.
Are you saying there was fire in a crowded theater?
There was fire in a crowded theater, although I'm not sure whether this is an 18th century insult, like throwing a shoe at George Bush. Is this like you throw a candle on the stage and that's a sign that... That's the ultimate disrespect in the theater.
Yeah, it's very bad luck to either say Macbeth or burn down the whole building. Actors hate it.
So at that point, everyone, rushes to the exits. It's a big kerfuffle. The Duke of Cumberland actually, I think, leaves his sword behind. This being a time when you would bring a sword to the theater. Everyone had walking sticks.
I think it'd be funny if he's the only one who actually wore a mask, Duke of Cumberland.
He's there like...
He's like, waiting. Where's that guy?
Guess who I am? Yeah, right. Everybody in the place would have had a walking stick, but perchance that the bottle conjurer would play the harpsichord on it.
They've got to lean on it loosely, even if they don't get chosen.
So the sensible people all rush for the exits, but the rabble remains in the theater and tears it to ribbons. They uproot the seats, they pull down all the curtains, they basically gut the place. Someone steals the purse from the box office, the riot spills out into the street, and it becomes front page news. In all the tabloids the following day.
Remind me, is this theater, is it owned by one of the aristocrats in question or just affiliated with? Is this hurting him in his own pocket?
No, theater, I mean, he was affiliated with it in the sense that he sponsored this production, but no, it's now, the theater still exists.
Oh.
It's now known as Theatre Royal Haymarket, and it has become part of the crown, the crown possessions. Yes. There are all these different levels of ownership of things on behalf of the crown. And there's their private income, but then there are all these pieces of real estate that the crown nominally owns, but that are actually in trust to the people of England and are managed and provide income to the treasury that I think are, transferred to the UK government at some point by a king that didn't want to manage the paying the exchequer anymore.
Right.
And said, in lieu of that, why don't you just take all these theaters and farms that I own?
I'm trying to think if I've ever seen anything at the Royal Haymarket. I'm looking at a list and I don't think I have.
Have you been to a lot of West End theaters?
Yeah. Yeah. It's especially like when we were like, I've only been to London a handful of times,
but it was your vacation spot for your family for a long
sometimes. Time. Sometimes. And it's, theater is like oddly, especially then was oddly cheap compared to in the States.
Yeah.
And you could often get, half price day of show tickets or when I was younger, student rush tickets.
You pay double and a guy would get into a pint bottle.
Yeah, exactly. The half price tickets don't include a guy playing harpsichord on a cane, but it might have Vanessa Redgrave.
How fascinating. I've never seen a theatrical production in London and have only ever seen one Broadway show. I've seen shows off Broadway, by which I mean Brooklyn. But I've only ever seen The Phantom of the Opera, and it was only because...
And 30 times, weirdly.
I only saw it once because my millennial girlfriend said that her father took them to Broadway shows. That was their way of being entertained. And she had seen The Phantom of the Opera like 14 times, and it was a big part of her big part of her cultural language. And she took it to me and I was excited. I was like, oh, wow, I've never been to a Broadway show. And it was very dumb.
For a special treat, you should go see a West End theater company doing just some American playwright, doing Neil Simon or something.
With Kevin Spacey in the lead?
No, he won't be there anymore. But I actually did see something at his old Vic, but now I can't remember what it was. It was the closing night of some Stoppard thing.
So they do a long day's journey into night, and it's hilarious.
Well, yeah, the accents are, they're always like, Felix Unger will be like, I'm sick of everything, Oscar. You know, they
try to do their American accents.
Yeah, they'll do American accents if they're doing Tennessee Williams. Sometimes it doesn't quite make it. That's a good time.
Well, so this became the Bottle Conjurer became the. Sort of greatest scandal of its time. I mean, not political scandal, but like cultural scandal. This was the...
Was there some element of class discontent in it that we're... Because that would be the story today.
Right.
You know, some out-of-touch celeb making us play things for the rich.
No, what it did was it became kind of like the Twitter scandal of its day. Every wag in the culture needed to have a hot take on it.
Hmm.
And it proved the Duke of Montagu's point because the wags directed their wit not at whoever the culprit was because the aristocrats that had perpetrated this prank were anonymous at the time. It was only much later that the Duke of Montagu was
they didn't know the full story
implicated. Yeah. And the thing is, he died later that year at the young age of 53. By July of that year, he was dead. So. It's maybe a little curious that this was ultimately sort of hanged around his neck or hung around his neck because he wasn't there to defend himself. So maybe it was actually the Duke of Portland that suggested it first. But Montagu
took the fall. I hope it led to like Truth in Advertising.
Well, in fact, the opposite. So ooh. Now it was a joke to... put advertisements to, you know, it was a joke for the well-heeled to pay for advertisements in the newspapers of mocking possible shows. So here's one of the advertisements that appeared in the local broadsides. The most wonderful and surprising Dr. Benimbe Zamanpoango, oculist and body surgeon to Emperor Manoimungi, who will perform on Sunday next at the Little Tea in the Haymarket, the following surprising operations, viz. First, he desires any one of the spectators only to pull out his own eyes, which as soon as he done, the doctor will show them to any lady or gentleman then present to convince them there is no cheat, and then replace them in the sockets as perfect and entire as ever. Secondly, he desires any officer or other to rip up his own belly, which when he has done, he, without any equivocation, takes out his bowels, washes them, and returns them to their place without the person suffering the least hurt. Thirdly, he opens the head of a J of P, and that's a reference.
Opens the head of a jar of preserves.
I think
it's a justice of the peace.
A justice of the peace, perhaps. Takes out his brains and exchanges them for those of a calf, the brains of a bow of those of an ass, and here of a bully for that of a sheep. Which operations will render the persons more sociable and rational creatures than they ever were in their lives?
Wow.
So there were so many of these broadsides taken out, or so many ads in the newspapers taken out, that there was a measurable increase in income for the newspapers.
Were these all satirical, fake, comedic things? There was no show attached?
All. At one point, one of the newspaper articles that followed said, the reason that the Bottle Conjurer did not appear was that prior to the show, he appeared in a private audience with a wealthy patron who, having paid him £5 to get into the bottle, put a cork in the bottle and now carries the Bottle Conjurer around in his waistcoat. Opening the bottle only periodically to feed him.
Do you think he can grant wishes now?
With an eyedropper. Well, that seems like, right, the influence.
I'm going to rub the bottle and make the guy do close-up magic for me.
So I learned of the Bottle Conjurer because it became such a well-known event in its time that it made its way as one of 1 million references into Moby Dick.
Ah.
The book that I recently completed.
I assumed
part
it was going to be a
club.
Decemberist song, but no, Melville.
Right? Where's Colin Malloy? I know he listens to the show. So, Colin, here it is, your opportunity, The Bottle Conjurer.
The Ballad of the Bottle Conjurer. Let's hear it. And that concludes The Bottle Conjurer. Entry 145.PS11983, certificate number 16793, in the omnibus. For supplementary omnibus material in our era, you could always go to @omnibusproject on any social media platform, the scourge of our society, and hopefully yours as well. I was at Ken Jennings. You could find John online at via his Patreon. We received email at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. If you would like to communicate with us or suggest lyrics to Colin Malloy's Bottle Conjurer song, please forward them to us. What rhymes with conjurer?
Oh, wanderer.
Ganja.
Ooh, ganja.
Fur.
Ganja fur.
Ganja fur.
Ooh, ganja fur, the purple buds.
I don't think that's a
the purple
thing.
Hairy buds.
You can send us physical objects if they won't fit an email. Anything larger or less digital than an email has to go through the post.
Larger than a bread box also would fit into a bread box.
We actually, the Legos we got on the last show were larger than a bread box. Here's a couple items recently sent to the Omnibus Project. Kim asked, apparently you requested somebody to send you soft cheese, and Kim is a cheesemonger, and she wants you to know that you should not send soft cheese through the mails.
Even American cheeses, American soft cheeses,
like pasteurized,
have been pasteurized
the hell out of them.
She says, do not send soft cheese through the mail. All right.
But she sent us stickers with cheese puns, which I'm sure is your second preference if you can't get soft cheese.
You can put them on the back of your minivan.
You just want a sticker of a cow saying, sweet dreams are made of cheese. Who am I to disagree?
Does the cow look like Annie Lennox?
As cows go, maybe, kind of pale with a long face. But I don't think it's anything particularly bovine about Annie Lennox. She's,
no.
What animal is she? A flamingo?
Annie Lennox would be
cockatoo.
I would think of her as something. Well, you really think she's a bird, huh?
Annie maybe. Lennox? Isn't there something,
I think she's more of a ocelot.
Oh, yeah. She's a lemur.
Yeah, well, she's more, I think she's fiercer than a lemur. I think she's a predatory creature.
What's fiercer than a lemur?
Well, an ocelot.
There we go. Do you know how to titillate an ocelot? We also received, I have to get this out of its bubble wrap because I don't even know what it is. Some artwork from, ASMR.
Oh,
bubble,
listen to that.
Bubble wrap ASMR.
Ooh, hot.
No extra cost. This is from Justin. It's a gift to your daughter. Or for your friend, the former minifigure collector.
Oh.
I'm an artist and professor here in BK? In Burger King?
British Knights?
Is that a K?
Is
that?
He is, or whoever this person is, however they identify, they're writing at the diagonal. They're writing on the diagonal on this piece of paper, which has a toucan on it.
Well, on the front, it's some kind of tropical beach vacation stationery. Where he scratched out the name of the owner and written, the Stones are better than the Beatles. So, sir, you have my attention.
Whoa, hot take.
Sir, you had my notice. Now you have my attention. But Justin has been doing new acrylics of minifigures, and look what he got your daughter.
Oh, it's the Luke in
X-Wing
garb. With lightsaber.
Which he doesn't usually have in his ship, because if it turns on, man.
Well, now listen, we had this conversation, she and I, yesterday. She said,
this is a timely gift.
She said, this looks like Luke, but it doesn't have to be Luke. It could be any X-Wing pilot.
If he can use a lightsaber.
And then I said, lightsaber.
You think Wedge has a lightsaber?
And she says, he wouldn't bring his lightsaber on an X-Wing. And I said, when he goes to Dagobah...
Oh, that's true.
He has a lightsaber.
Maybe he sticks it into R2 the way he does at the beginning of Jedi.
What I'm going to say
is... Or it's in the overhead bin.
Luke goes everywhere with the lightsaber, because what if he crashes his X-Wing? He's going to need his lightsaber. Luke's always going to have his lightsaber.
Look, when you board a plane, maybe you have a weapon you always carry. I'm not sure. When you board a plane, do you have it on your ankle?
No, it
wouldn't be safe.
Well, you know how many leather men I've lost at the airport?
Swiss Army knife keychain. I've donated 4 or 5 to CTAC.
Yeah, I stopped carrying a pocket knife as a result.
Well, I think Luke would check his lightsaber. That's not canon. That's just common sense.
If you are flying your private aircraft, you can carry as many M16s on it as you want.
I don't know if you'd hold it lit though.
Oh, I see. I see what you're saying.
Like, I don't even know if it would be on his belt, because you jiggle in your seat and suddenly you take out your kneecap.
Let's say he plugs it into R2. Anyway, an incredibly
Beautiful work, Justin.
And an incredibly apropos painting to arrive right now, because we have this figure in play.
Yeah, as I came into your house today, your daughter was taking off Luke's helmet, and she didn't put a wig on, so he was just bald, bump-headed Luke.
She does this. She takes off their hair, and often takes off their heads. She has minifigures sitting around with no heads, and I say, "What's going on with this person?" And she says, "That's not a person. That's just their clothes." So she'll have a
she'll have a
minifigure, and then
she's Buffalo Bill from Buffalo Bob from Silence of the Lambs. Got it.
That's right. I'm so beautiful.
Thank you, Justin. That's a lovely impressionist look at Luke as a minifigure.
Fantastiche.
That's really a high bar. You would have to have some very funny cow puns or some very skilled minifigure artwork if you hope to compete with Justin and Kim. But thank you.
Send us your quilts. Send us your...
Did I read the address? I don't know if I did.
No, I don't think so.
The P.O. Box is Omnibus Project, P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. If you want to see all these weird things we get, the way to see them is by becoming a subscriber to our Patreon at the tier that lets you see the weird video stuff. I really couldn't recommend our Patreon higher.
Ken and Mindy populate the Patreon with all kinds of content. There are photographs of everything we receive. At a certain level, you will receive in the mail, your mail, signed show notes from one of our shows.
These are all tests of gullibility, just like the bottle conjurer. We don't actually deliver any of these things.
No, we actually do. And in fact, yesterday, Ken and I got on a Zoom call with one of our donors, and had a delightful phone call with one of our queens.
It was
a queen's residence.
I was wondering how that sentence was going to end.
Queens
with one of
Gambit.
Our queens of the Stone Age. He suggested a show topic which I'm very interested in, but I need to read the book in question, so I have it on hold at the library. Tom.
That's one of your upcoming shows, because you're not even revealing the topic to me.
Oh yeah, it's a secret, and I don't know when the library is going to give it to me, so.
Oh, right.
It could be a very long con for Tom here.
This show is still being recorded within the quarantine. Now, maybe by the time it airs, everyone will have had the vaccine and they'll all be out kissing each other.
Wouldn't it be nice if we were speaking to a vaccinated audience who just licked a doorknob right before they put on the show?
I'm still going to wear masks when I get on airplanes.
I think I'm going to do it for life. I didn't have a cold this year.
I didn't either.
It was fantastic.
It really was.
Nobody had the flu. Like, literally nobody in America had the flu. It was insane.
Not a single stuffy nose. And I would happily live the rest of my life without a stuffy nose.
You can, what did I say? Oh, you can also find, so yeah, check out the Patreon if you're not a donor. Good original content. You can find your fellow Omnibus connoisseurs at the Futurelings group on Discord or Reddit, or especially Facebook, and they're a lovely group of people, and today they're still talking about Lego. I think we made it a permanent Lego form accidentally.
And over on my Patreon, there's also a discourse group that talks about Omnibus quite a bit.
Oh, there you go.
But you're not a member of my Patreon, so you wouldn't know.
I'd have to donate, right?
Yeah.
Hard pass.
Come on.
I brought you the mail instead.
That's nice. I got this nice painting.
So. I donate to your Patreon in terms of personal acts of service.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come.
Wouldn't that be nice?
I mean, Ken does more praying than I do. I do a lot of hoping.
Of all the times for a catastrophe to come, never is pretty good.
Never is good. If the worst comes soon, however, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.